City Limits. Brought to us by the People's Committee for Melbourne every Wednesday at 9 a.m.
City Limits is Melbourne's only hour devoted to our urban environment,
to transport and planning and housing issues,
to privatisations and our utility services,
to building and or maintaining a sense of community. 855 on the AM band, if we can hear it through the noise and find it through the smog.
City Limits.
Good morning. You are listening to City Limits on 3CR Community Radio as part of our May Day special broadcast here on 3CR, running from, when did it start? 12:30 last night, all the way up until 7:30 tonight. I'm in the studio with Mr. Kevin Healy, getting ready for our May Day related program. But before we kick off, I thought I'd play a little song for listeners in case you didn't already know which Wednesday of the month it is.
Okay, can I just butt in before you put the music on?
Butt in.
I'll pour us a cup of tea so we can have a tea while we're listening to it.
Oh, that's gorgeous.
What a good idea.
What a wonderful idea. Here, let's...
I thought that was brilliant.
Oh.
There we go.
Thank you very much. All right, here's a clue for our listeners. Let's see if you can guess.
Oh, what is that I see yonder
coming, coming, coming?
Oh, what is that
coming,
I see yonder
coming, coming, coming?
What is that
coming,
I see yonder
coming, coming, coming?
Get on board, Lord, when you get on board.
It's that Union train
coming, coming, coming.
It's that
Union train coming, 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 coming.
It's that
Union
train
coming, coming, coming. Get on board,
Lord, won't you
get on board.
It has saved a many a
thousand, thousand, thousand.
It has saved a many a
thousand, thousand, thousand.
It has saved a many a
thousand, thousand, thousand. Get on board, Lord, won't you get on board.
It will save many more
thousand, thousand, thousand.
It will save many more
thousand, thousand, thousand.
It will save many more
thousand, thousand, thousand. Get on board, Lord, get on board.
It will carry us to
freedom, freedom, freedom.
It will
carry
us to
freedom, freedom, freedom.
It will
freedom, 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 freedom. Get on board, 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 get on board.
Oh, what is that I see yonder
coming, coming, coming?
Oh, what is that
coming,
I see yonder
coming, coming, coming?
What is that
coming,
I see yonder
coming, coming, coming? Get on board, board, get on board.
It's at you. Union train
coming, coming, coming.
It's at you.
Union
train
coming, coming, coming.
It's at you.
Union
train
coming, coming, coming. Get on board, 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 get on board.
That's right, listeners. That was Union Train by the Almanac Singers. Kevin, would you like to tell us what Wednesday of the month is it?
It's the first Wednesday. It's our transport day. And John McPherson, our regular transport commentator, is having a day off today. John will be back next month and talk about lots of things transport. But because it's May Day, we're doing specific stuff to do with May Day issues. And we're going to have shortly in the studio Monica Hart, who these days is a social worker, but in fact very shortly... Very shortly in the... I was just saying we're going to shortly have in the studio Monica Hart, and she walked to the door. Monica, in another life, she's currently a social worker. Another life was president of the Tramways Union at the time when that big industrial dispute took place in the early 1990s with all the trams on Melbourne streets. And Monica's going to talk about that history and the role of the union then. And later on, we're going to have Jack Howard, who also did some research for the Rail, Bus and Tram Union on unionism and on the history of the union. He's going to come on later in the show and talk to us about that as well, Monica. So, you want a cup of tea, Monica, now you're here.
Thank you.
And that'd be lovely. Good morning to you.
There you are. Thank you. Okay, so that's it. And we're going to play a song in between as well. So there we are. But just a few things before we get on to that. And we'll get on pretty early to Monica and the industrial dispute. But a few things. I noticed that the I know you had a view on this, Monica, but I raised with you the other day the fact that while we think obviously the issue is incredibly important, the different attitude by the media and our politicians going to rallies, etc., when it comes to something that's safe politically in a sense, like domestic violence, as opposed to not seeing the same politicians or nor get the same coverage of Palestine rallies, for instance. Just that difference, I think, is interesting. I know you have a view about it, though, as well.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely absolutely correct in terms of the media coverage of Palestine, Kevin. I mean, that stands alone. Mm-hmm. But I also think that the history and the struggle to give credence and actually have recognition to the depth of domestic violence in this country has also been a difficult one. I'm thinking of the community groups and the women who have fought for years to have recognition and get government intervention that was required around domestic violence. But I've also thought of the distortion that has often occurred in media too, in terms of how it's often been presented. And I can't pluck cases out of my mind exactly at the time, but I can recall where the role of the perpetrator has been absolutely underplayed by the media. So I think the scrutiny needs to sit over both, but yeah, perhaps differently. But I certainly think there's been a notion to downplay that as being male violence and as being partner violence and as just in naming it as partner and partner murder as well. So I think that part also needs to be really understood and articulated. And while we're seeing the media giving credence and giving dues at the current time, we've also got to look a little bit back a little bit further.
Because it's been in the news, you know, periodically over the years. There's always these outbursts when and they suddenly have rallies and things go on. So in fact, despite all that, nothing has really happened much. I mean, we're still, I don't think there's been a real improvement in the incidence of violence. And in fact, this morning on Radio National earlier also, there was an interview with a woman from Homelessness Victoria, Homelessness Australia, and she was talking about the real problems women face because there's just nearly enough government support. So while they're marching, they need to be doing a lot more.
And I think the underreport, and you just mentioned homelessness, the level of violence that would be there unreported, particularly for many women who are homeless, particularly for many women living in second class boarding houses. Mm. I think for that group of women, very, very underrepresented in any statistics that exist, underrepresented in reporting and underrepresented in response.
And she made
either
the point
either
that
from police or from anyone. So yeah, well, the vulnerability of that group is large.
She made the point that you talked about, like rooming houses and things where they're in danger as well, that many women are then forced to go back to the original situation because of the situation outside.
That's absolutely true. Absolutely true, where the avenues that would have been open to women once in terms of housing. If we think of only, you only got to think of what your housing waiting list is like. So the avenues that would have been open for people to have an option for safe, secure housing for themselves and their families, that's just closed to people. Yeah, it is closed.
I saw a figure recently where even for emergency housing, the waiting list is something like 10 months or something. Well, that's a long time to wait when you're getting bashed.
There's families in cars, there's families on streets.
Yeah.
And families separated. children who are in care because of that.
All right, I'll get on to some industrial stuff shortly, but one I did want to raise, and I want to thank Karina for this. Karina, the other day, have you met each other, by the way, officially?
I
have
not. Hi there. John.
We introduced you on air. But Karina alerted me to last week, in fact, gave me a copy of The Australian, which had this front page, anti-Israel ACTU stirs Jewish fury, to think, what have they done? How terrible. And they've made three demands of the Labor government. And you're not going to believe this, Monica. This is how bad it is. What they're demanding is that the government stop supporting Israel at all, which is, you know, goodness me. They also want to stop trade, military trade with Israel. And the third one, which is really serious, inject a further 100 million of humanitarian aid to Gaza and the West Bank. So the fury is over wanting 100 million in humanitarian aid to go to the Israelis. I just found that absolutely incredible. And the headline in The Australian, anti-Israel ACTU stirs Jewish fury.
And very, very Commons request demands to what's been made by a number of councils, They are the broad demands which are being reflected back by the by.
I didn't introduce it, but you are also a Marybeck councillor, and you've, because your council's taken a very strong stand.
Yes, we have.
Yeah.
I'd just like to make a brief disclaimer, Kevin, before you move on. Actually, I didn't buy that copy of The Australian last week.
No, I
happened upon it. It was given to me.
So I wasn't going to go to that because I thought people might think you stole it or something, Karina. I thought that would be awful. But
no, I didn't steal it. It was just the end of the day. It was just the end of the day, Kevin, and the kind proprietor at the shop gave it to me after I was interested in the headline. So I just had to make a disclaimer for everybody. I'm not buying that.
The gift of serendipity.
Well, one, I know that you were interested in, you actually bought a financial review because of it. And we'll get on to industrial stuff now because they've been building it up. Last week there was an article where a judge who himself has been under a bit of pressure, actually, because it's argued he takes too long to come down with decisions. But anyway, the judge has watchdog let CFMEU off hook over threats, and the judge complained that since the government has knocked off the Jackboots Commission that the Liberals had, there's been no, you know, the CFMEU is getting away with murder, so to speak. It's really terrible.
Just to clarify, that's the ABCC, right?
The ABCC, that's right.
Australian Building and Construction Commission.
Jackboots Commission, that's it. then this week on Monday, they followed up again. No new claims filed since taking on ABCC role. Watchdog drops cases over CFMEU, and it's a terrible situation. The Fin Review's really upset about this one. The workplace watchdog. Now, and you had a couple of comments on this article, Karina, the other day as well, didn't you?
I know. I even made you laugh at one of my jokes. Well, it wasn't really a joke. It was just reading an excerpt of the paper.
That's right.
What was it?
You want me to read it?
No, I'll read it.
Okay.
The Fair Work Ombudsman has not... that was under the title of Watchdog Drops Cases Over CFMEU.
Yep.
Fair Work Ombudsman has not filed any new cases against the CFMEU in the 18 months since it took over compliance for the industry, despite claims that the militant union is telling workers no ticket, no start, and kicking non-CFMEU subcontractors off sites.
Isn't that disgraceful?
God forbid.
Yeah, that's right.
The militancy.
Well, that's the very reason why unions should exist.
Which was normal practice.
That's right.
No ticket, no start.
It should be.
Before Reith and Howard came along.
No, it was normal practice.
Absolutely normal practice. Well, then, don't worry, it gets worse. Yesterday, it was Monday morning, just making sure we've got the point, police called over CFMEU skirmish P1. So another a skirmish on a site, and of course it's
the Queensland one.
The union spot. Yeah, up in Queensland.
Queensland,
that's
one,
it. Yeah, that's right.
It's good to see unions still doing the job in Queensland.
That's right. And you're going to find it hard to believe, but I don't need to read on. But yesterday's Finroot, that the say, yep, it was yesterday, and the back in the paper, the editorial. Oh, this really, sit down. You are sitting down, aren't you? Anyway, Labor greenlights toxic bully boys at the CFMEU is the editorial. Is there any need to read on?
No. And I think the Queensland one where there was a, I think the organiser wasn't allowed on site, so.
That was it.
So
yeah.
they went around and
they broke
just
illegally.
Just went over the, yeah, found another entry.
Yeah. Anyone else want to top up at all of any sort?
I think it's worth noting on May Day that we have so much in terms of conditions and wages to thank building and construction industry unions over the years for, and you know, many of the conditions that aren't really, you know, we all know the story, but.
Well, what the conditions were like for building workers before the union really got them, you know, years and years ago, and the sites were just death traps.
Also, like, you know, when you think of, yeah, I mean, union, it's the whole nature of work that's changed, but also, like, down on the wharfs, the conditions that the wharf...
The wharfies are the same, yeah. Yeah.
And the absolute monopoly of labour that existed.
Yeah. Well, the wharf is actually you go every day and if you're called up, you've got
that's
a day's work.
Right.
I mean, you didn't even have permanent jobs.
And I guess the accusations of things like thuggery and, you know, using this kind of language is always, should always be looked at also through a class lens.
Yeah. And in terms of just wages generally at the moment, we know they're, you know, they're bloody low and they never catch up with inflation. But again, even the Herald Sun had an article, have job but no rental. And again, it's the homeless group talking about it. But the number of Victorians, and particularly women with jobs, reaching out to homelessness services has surged amid skyrocketing rents, etc. The incredible increase, research by the Council to Homeless Persons revealed 12,146 wage earners in the state sought homelessness assistance in the previous financial year, a 1,700% increase on the year before. And Casey Wyndham, Greater Geelong, Greater Bendigo, Greater Dandenong are the worst areas. But again, there you have workers actually working but still can't afford a roof over their heads.
Being displaced.
And at the same time, and we know that the aged care workers got a pay rise that varied with different classes, but 13.5% was the top. But the federal government now wants to delay the pay rise for 2 years. And their argument is that it will drag workers away from other areas that are having trouble finding workers. Now, I thought the reason for it was to get workers into the industry anyway.
Yeah, that's right.
But secondly, if one thinks logically, if the other workers are leaving because they're not getting enough money and going to that, why not increase the wages for the other workers? It's not a bad thought. Probably a terrible thought when you think about it. I'm sure that would have... That would have Innes Willocks from the industrial group, profits group, screaming and yelling, but just it was just a thought. Yeah. And the other one before, and we'll go on to you after this, Monica, but one I did find fascinating, in a column that does a bit of satirical stuff in the Fin Review, it talks about the fact that Grilled has reached its 20th birthday. That's some sort of franchise mob. And the owner is very rich and he's done a few interviews, including one in The Australian and one for the, I didn't know they had it, but the Carlton Football Club has a business channel, interviews people, which is be worth having a look at, wouldn't it? But
why am I not surprised?
Yeah, that's true. Well, they've got that bloke who's in a bit of trouble over Price Waterhouse. Grilled is, he's very rich, but then even this article in the Financial Review says, unions and workers have accused Grilled of compulsory enrolling all new store workers in a government subsidised training scheme. Their enrolment is then used to shave dollars off their hourly rate. To the end of the last financial year, this publication reported that Grilled had banked a total of $28.3 million in government subsidies to run the training scheme from which most of the trainees never managed to graduate. And we don't know what the precise impact is on their wages bill, but it's surely considerable. And it goes on and talks about the fact that he says we're a good company, but is it good to take workers down? And is directly cuts against the do-good, no-good burger chain, etc. So, but there you are. So I think we recommend we don't go to Grilled. Not that we do, but we
don't. I didn't even know what it was.
No, that's
no,
right.
I've not on my radar. Kevin,
no, it's
I
not.
Have to say.
It's definitely not. And I mentioned this last week, Monica, but you'll love this. I thought it was worth mentioning again on May Day. Andrew Lee, who's a Labor Party economist, he's the assistant minister to assistant minister for some assistant minister or something in the Treasury area. He's written a book called The Shortest History of Economics, in which he quotes people like McDonald's, he was in the franchise, he quotes Paul McCartney, he talks about a particular model, a well-known Australian model, he talks about a chimpanzee, and he quotes well-known economists like Keynes, Smith and Friedman and those people, Milton, of course, a great contributor to economics. Marx and Engels, now he's a Labor Party, Marx and Engels, not a word. Not a word. Now, there was a time when one might have thought a Labor Party bloke writing a history of economics might base it on Marx and Engels. I don't even get a word. And he's a Labor minister.
I was going to say that you were clutching your pearls in the studio, but that's kind of, you know, it's inappropriate for the topic, isn't it? He's clutching his beard, listeners. He's clutching his beard in outrage.
All right, look, we'll move on to Monica Hart and we'll talk about Monica, the industrial dispute background to it. It was many people, I'm sure, the older people, anyway, remember the trams being on the street for a fair few weeks at that time. But what was the background and how did it all come about?
Yeah, it's interesting because I forget that I certainly work with a lot of younger folk. And when
just the background again, I forgot to mention it. You were president of the union and you were a bus driver because at that time the tramways also ran a bus service.
Well, I was a bus driver later. Tram Connie, then tram driver, and was working in the union office as a president of the union. But I forget how many people haven't grown up with the tram conductors and the tramway system that we know it today and don't have actually any knowledge any knowledge of that dispute. But it's also lovely when I meet people who do. And I was at a rally not so long ago and someone came up to me and could recall that they were about maybe they were a child, they were maybe four or five, but their parents had brought them into the city to see, as part of that dispute, the trams were all placed in the city. They were there for nearly 6 weeks. But their recollection was of a child being brought into the city to actually witness and see the outcome of the dispute. But just in terms of what that background was, Kevin, and I guess just going back, there'd been over the years, both by Liberal and Labor governments, a number of attempts. You had the Loney report. You had different reports that were looking at bringing changes into transport, which is one of the big changes was to get rid of tram conductors. But also the changes were around tram conductors, station assistants, guards on the railways, closure of railway lines. So you had successive governments attempting to inverted commas reform public transport here in Victoria. And then what you had with the Labor government, and it would have been in 1989, they were looking at introducing a whole suite of changes. And unions were called into the minister's office. Jim Cannon was the minister at that time, 5 o'clock on a Friday it was, called up to his office, sat around the table. It was Tramways Union, Railways Union at the time, separate unions, and a whole host of the unions that worked in the industry, the metal, all the different trade unions. And they were informed of the changes that were going to happen and set in concrete. And basically it was the elimination of the removal of the tram conductors, it was the removal of the station assistants, the introduction of a new ticketing system. There was the guards, although they'd had a number of attempts to look at removing the guards, but that was sort of also part of it. But also
those with a memory who don't remember, guards were actually, there was a guard on every train in the back carriage. And at the end of the back carriage.
So then the other issues that were put on that table at the time was the closure of railway lines. And in particular, one of the lines was the upfield upfield line. So they were all part of what was being proposed and what was the agenda of the government at that time. So it was absolutely massive change. The ticketing system was a scratch ticket system they were introducing. But what as part of that, the first cab off the rank in what they were proposing in their timelines was actually the tramways and the conductors. So that was a very strategic decision. Tramways were quite a tiny union. We probably had less than 3,000 members here in Victoria. So we were the first cab. They obviously, I think, sought to target it. They'd already had a lot of dispute around with the guards previously. I think they saw that it was going to be a lot tougher battle if they were to move in on the ARU as first port of call. They were already trying to look at the closure of the railway lines. So I guess I really emphasise that because I think if we start to think that this was just a move around tickets and conductors, we're missing the whole picture of what the government was looking at doing. They were looking at what they were looking at doing in transport and what they were looking at doing in terms of the transport unions, who they saw as being powerful and stepping in their way of what they considered the reforms that they needed to make in terms of transport. So I think we have to be able to see that whole bigger picture of what was being put before the unions at that point, so that when we look at, I guess, the resistance of the Tramways Union, we actually see it in the context of what that broader picture. I think that's what's really critical here. Yeah. I can go on sort of, but you
on,
might want
to... Yeah, lead up to the actual dispute, yeah. So that was the Friday night.
And that would have been, Kevin, and I haven't gone back and looked back and sort of, maybe Jack's got a lot, closer knowledge from a sort of a history and theoretical of all the dates and times. But that was quite a long time. And so what happened in terms of the Tramways Union? There was an incredibly strong, I think, feeling across, but the union, I think, worked to actually, there was a strong feeling, I think, across the tramways industry about the importance of conductors on trams, the role of conductors. Tramways was a really interesting, I always called it such a melting pot as well. We were such a diverse community of workers. Each depot, different depots had basically grounded in I think, for different groups who had migrated here. We had many groups that maybe had more of a Greek and Italian base. There's other groups were Sri Lankan and Indian. I worked at Q Depot, which had a large group of workers who'd come from Vietnam, who were living around sort of in the Richmond Flats. So there was this very cosmopolitan feel to the whole of the tramways industry. And then we had South Melbourne, which was very much a depot where we had a large number of LGBTIQ youth. It was known as a gay depot, but a diverse community in that depot. And, you know, I can particularly remember the number of people who found a working home and a lot of acceptance, trans people who were working in the industry at that time. So it was a wonderful industry of acceptance. And it also provided an avenue of people who probably would have really struggled with income. And I think of all the people who hadn't been here very long in the country, but were able to secure work. So there was a lot of allegiance to each other and allegiance to what we did as workers in transport and a lot of belief in public transport. The belief in serving the public, the belief in public transport was very high. And I think I would counter that it was probably a lot higher in the tramways industry than it was in the rail, simply because of that different level of contact and that intimacy that often existed between conductors and the public. So it made it, in a way, a very easier, in some ways, to organise. And so what the union had done had slowly built up a lot of a lot of publicity. We would have days of non-ticketing days, non-fare days. We had days of leafleting. We had days of short stoppages and a lead up to having meetings in the city where we would bring the trams into the city for a 4-hour stoppage. So that had happened over a period of maybe six to eight months, a lot of work with other unions because the scratch ticket system was being introduced, a lot of work with, say, the printing unions to try and understand where that printing was being done, trying to block it. So the campaign that the union organised and ran was incredibly diverse, very effective, and the other part of that campaign was around community. Community just began to seriously. We had petitions. We had a lot of ways for people to voice their opposition around issues of safety. We had did a lot of work with people with disabilities. A lot of there was women's groups. There were people coming forward with around prams on trams, access issues. All of those issues started to be heard and to surface. So there was not only this strong campaign, sort of the industrial campaign within the union. There was this incredible linkage to community. So for me, one of the strengths in which I talk repeatedly about is it showed that importance of unions not being separate and that strength of unions and community campaign together. Mm. And that was the... that was one of the key strengths of this campaign. And what it took, I mean, I think what one part of what the public saw, I guess, was on the 1st of January, where it became so, the trams actually eventually stopped, I think, that evening. But that working together prior to that was absolutely critical, and I'm going to just sort of reference that in terms of things that are happening in my own community and in Marybeck now, where there's a campaign around access, but access of trams, particularly on the 19 route for low floor trams and for accessible tram stops. And that's a campaign to me that's generated so much widespread community support. Mm. And it mirrors and reflects to me, and we've had, and I've sort of been involved in that, but certainly having discussions and talking to the union as well. But it, in many ways, it mirrors for me some of that early campaign going back all those years ago that was there around conductors, and that ability to link together diverse community groups, but particularly to link unions and community.
Yeah. So how did the trams end up on the street at the end of all that?
Okay. The new changes were to happen on the 1st of January 1990, and that the new changes basically was that the trams from that point in the morning would operate without conductors, that they'd be driver trams. Workers who showed up for work that day were presented with a contract that they had to sign, that they'd work at the direction, basically that they were going to work as one person operated, or that they'd work at the direction of the requirement of management. Strong resistance, shall we say, across the industry. Workers took very direct action. They refused to sign those contracts that they were being presented with, and they made it very clear to management that they would not be signing any of that. And in fact, some of those pages of agreements, I think some of them had water thrown at them, so that no one could sign them anyway. There was various methods used to not participate in what management were requesting. Management as a whole left all the depots that day. So while they'd been there to run the trams and sign people on, and after some confrontation between workers and management, which was largely non-cooperation, I have to say, largely non-cooperation, management retreated from the depots. Across the board, they left the depots. So workers then had a commitment to run the trams, run the industry. So cooperatively at each depot, they knew the schedules and they worked the depots. The trams ran out of the depots on that 1st of January and they continued to run the service all day with no management, no, well, we called them braids, no inspectors. So, and worked very effectively. Effectively, workers themselves organised to keep those trams operating. And to, you know, you've got a schedule, you know, and there were people there coordinating, getting trams back into the depots, getting other trams out, being able to coordinate. It wasn't that difficult to do. So the trams operated, I think we didn't, I don't think we did fares that day, from memory. I'm sure we didn't. So the trams operated with conductors, with two-person operation. That evening, there was a message that came through to the union office because the union went into work that day because we knew what was happening out in the industry. A message came through quite late, maybe at 8 or 9 o'clock. A message came in that the government's intent was to isolate workers and turn the power off in all the depots that evening. So that basically they were turning off Melbourne's trams in response.
Mm.
There was a union executive, an emergency union executive. A big concern was workers were going to be isolated in depots. It would be presented that workers were on strike. We had a commitment to still run trams. We wanted to. So workers did bring the trams into the city that night with a view that if the trams were in the city, it would stop the power being turned off. And we would be able to...
it was to stop a government lockout.
And we would be able to operate the trams and still work those trams, that you weren't leaving trams isolated or in each depot and effectively bringing Melbourne to a standstill. So the idea of the trams being in the city was that the power would be left on and that workers would be reporting, if need be, to the city to show that we're there and we're willing to work. We're willing to work. Our dispute is about what's happening with tram conductors, but we're there to work. And if need be, we'll report to Bourke Street. We'll report to Parliament, if need be, to work. What transpired, of course, was they turned the power off. Government made a decision and turned the power off to all that area that night or early in the morning.
And so for six weeks they sat there.
So by then you had trams effectively in the city. But the intent, the absolute intent, was to ensure that power remained and the ability of staff to work those trams remained.
Yeah.
That was the intent.
Okay, we better move on to Jack. But how was it resolved then? 6 weeks later, what was the end result?
There was a return to work. There was some split in the executive at that time. There was intervention from federal union body who did some of the final negotiation around that dispute. Members were pretty tired after 6 weeks. There was one depot which... And I think many members felt very betrayed. It was a whole mixture to the end of that dispute, as there always is, Kevin, always is in industrial
disputes.
It's
a long time to be out with
that
money.
But it is a long time. The intransigence of that dispute was massive. I guess the long term was that trams still operated for another, largely 7 years, partly. The transition to one person operation was a gradual transition. It was still a difficult transition.
Yeah.
But it was over a longer period with people being able to keep their jobs for a lot longer period. And the conversion that occurred being a lot more considered just in terms of driver safety and all the issues that ensured with one person operation.
Yeah. Well,
to finish off as well, Monica, just quickly, and in a way that might lead on to Jack, just briefly, after that, or maybe that was during the time that, to my understanding, the Tramways Union was amalgamated into a larger one, if you could give listeners just a brief kind of for timing as well after that, kind of what happened and whether that was also to do with what happened there.
You mean in terms of the amalgamation?
Yeah.
The amalgamation was certainly under discussion at that time, and I think the beginning of that amalgamation probably happened around, no, it wasn't, around probably 91. I'm not clear on those time frames. I'm not clear on those time frames anymore, but there was, look, I think from my point of view, there was certainly... that process of amalgamation was certainly one that was very desirable. In terms of you lost your certain identity, but it was certainly where industry was heading, and you needed to have that far more streamlined ability to work together. And there were times, I think, you know, and I don't have any pleasure in saying this, but that some of that process was quite a difficult one between the two unions. There was disputes, I think it was around the Grand Prix time, where, and I wasn't involved in the union at that time, where the Tramways Union had actually undermined, I would use the word, in terms of actions of the Railways Union. So you actually needed a far more cohesive force. I mean, we were divided, certainly around our time of our dispute, I think divided in terms of they were able to pick off the Tramways Union as the first union. I think the fact that they had such a battle meant that some of those, I think even I would often say that the ability to save the upfield line was probably assisted by the fact that they had such a hard battle. With the Tramways Union.
Well, ultimately,
but I think the ultimate thing of amalgamation meant that ability to pick off sections, and we certainly had support from the ARU doing our section, but we were separate unions.
Yeah.
So there was that. While we had support, we were different. So I think that, you know, I would always support. And part of that journey was a rocky road at times, because there was political differences between. But the leadership of the Tramways Union at that time and the leadership of the ARU at that particular point of amalgamation.
Right. We'll get Jack on the phone now. And while we're getting Jack, we'll play a song. Just to background this song, it's by Abe Harburg, who many people might know. He wrote the music for The Wizard of Oz. He wrote the music for a show called Finian's Rainbow, which has a beautiful song called How Are Things in Glockamora? But he did suffer a fair bit because he was a member of the American Communist Party as well. And he claims that a lot of the words in his song, in those shows, in fact, were quite subliminal messages. but he also wrote what I consider to be probably the anthem of the Great Depression of the 30s. And we'll play that, ironically, by a very rich person called Bing Crosby. But this is the version. But Abe Harburg wrote what I think is the anthem of the Depression. It's not a bad song for May Day. Let's play it while we get Jack.
Thanks for joining us this morning, Monica.
Oh, you're welcome.
They used to tell me I was building a dream, and so I followed the mob. When there was earth to plow or guns to bear, I was always there, right on the job. They used to tell me I was building a dream with peace and glory ahead. Why should I be standing in line, just waiting for bread? Once I built a railroad, I made it run, made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime? Once I built a tower up to the sun, brick and rivet and lime. Once I built a tower, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime? Once in khaki suits, gee, we look swell, full of that Yankee doodly-dum. Half a million boots went slogging through hell, and I was the kid with the drum. Say, don't you remember? They called me Al. It was Al all the time. Why don't you remember? I'm your pal. Say, buddy, can you spare a dime? Once in khaki suits, ah, gee, we look swell, full of that Yankee doodly-dum. Half a million boots went slogging through hell, and I was the kid with a drum. Oh, say, don't you remember? They called me Al. It was Al all the time. Say, don't you remember?
Okay, brother, can you spare a dime? That was Abe Harburg's contribution to the Depression, I guess. On the line, Jack Howard. Jack Howard, a young... Oh, no, he's not young. I keep calling him young. I don't know why I call Jack young. He's not young anymore. But Jack was a researcher and did history research for the Rail, Bus and Tram Union. And Jack, I don't know if you listened to what Monica was saying, but I got you on to talk about some of the history of some of the union activity over the years. So it's virtually carte blanche. Take it away.
Yeah, sure. I'll still gladly wear the badge of young.
Well, it's all relative, Jack, compared to where you are.
Exactly right. I can hear the feedback of my voice, by the way, but that's all right. I can persist despite that if that's not a technical issue. Well, look, the very first industry-wide railway union in Australia was the Victorian Railways Union. It formed in 1911. Up until that point, in all the railways across the Australian colonies, what you just had were craft-based unions, or it was just based on guild or section for the various employees, whether, say, they were working the stations or the tracks or whatever it may have been. But that remained at the level of guild unionism. From 1900s on, the Amalgamated Society of Railway Employees in Victoria started a campaign in earnest to bring all the different guild and craft unions on the railways together into one big industrial union. And the visionary of that, if you like, the leader of it, was the secretary of the Amalgamated Society of Railway Employees in Victoria, Frank Hyatt. Frank Hyatt was a member of the Victorian Socialist Party and later on became a very important figure in the anti-conscription campaign in World War One. Anyway, in 1911, almost all of the railway unions, with the exception of a train drivers, the AFULE, the Federated Union of Locomotive Enginemen, all balloted their members, and their members overwhelmingly voted to form one big union, the Victorian Railways Union. And then I think before the 1910s were out, it caught on to the rest of the states and territories, and you had the Australian Railways Union. That's where we start the story.
Right, where do we go from there?
Well, excellent question. Look, in the 1930s, during the Depression, the public transport unions, the Railways Union, the AFL-E and ATMO, the Trammies Union, they were in the forefront of a campaign for a 40-hour working week, staging rallies, strikes and so on. And eventually they did win a 44-hour working week from the arbitration court, which in the Great Depression wasn't nothing, even if it wasn't the 40-hour week, of course. Then 1942, ATMOA had won equal pay for women tramway workers, which mostly means conductors and other sort of auxiliary workers like that. And then finally, you finally have the winning of a 40-hour working week for Australian workers in 1947, better wages as well as penalty rates. And the public transport unions, you know, with their industrial muscle, played a certain outsized role in that. Now, of course, I could talk here about the Clary O'Shea 1969 general strike, but I suspect perhaps Monica already spoke about that before I came on.
No, I didn't. Monica talked about the trams, the 1990 strike, where the trams were on the streets for 6 weeks.
Yeah, yeah. I'm scurrying back and forth a bit here, going between the Railways Union and the Tramways Union. But for those of you listeners who don't know the history or didn't live it, in the 1950s, the Menzies government basically introduced penal fines that penalised or fined workers in unions for striking. So it was effectively a way of outlawing the right to strike or criminalising it. You had the militant left unions in Australia make concerted efforts over the next 10, 15 years to try and smash those laws or defy them and make them unworkable. And you had various sort of battles and near misses where the left unions were, you know, mounted a big campaign around a particular strike in an attempt to defeat those laws, but never quite got there. In 1969, what finally happened is the Victorian Tramways Union, a militant left union, deeply in arrears with the strike fines, but as a matter of policy, didn't pay the strike fines. So the Victorian Tramways Union Secretary, Clary O'Shea, was summoned to the Industrial Court in Melbourne to make available to the court his union's books to be inspected to see if they could pay the fines or not. Has already worked out and agreed to. Clary O'Shea refused to produce his union's books, defied the laws. So the Industrial Court, presided over by one judge, Sir John Kerr, sent Clary O'Shea to jail indefinitely until such a time as he purged his contempt and gave up the books. As a result of that, that triggered off a general strike which spread throughout Australia. Every big city and town in Australia, most of the workforce went on strike, went on for a whole week, basically demanding Clary O'Shea be set free and that the penal powers be smashed or that, you know, the penal powers be ended. As a consequence of that strike, it was the first big national general strike really since the end of World War II, scared the daylights out of Australia's ruling class. Within a week of that, a so-called Good Samaritan identity was brought forth who ostensibly paid the Tramways Union's fines so as to let them and the establishment off the hook. So Clary O'Shea victoriously was freed from jail, but that action reduced the penal powers or the penal fines, the anti-strike fine powers, to a dead letter. As a result of that, in the next 5 to 6, 7 years, Australian workers went on to secure the greatest advances they ever made of all time in wages, conditions and benefits because they didn't have these anti-strike laws shackling them any longer. If you like, it unleashed the working class's power and confidence.
Yeah, just on that issue, it's almost impossible to imagine why anyone would have contempt for John Kerr, Jack.
No, I can't possibly imagine. Perhaps Clary O'Shea had was a soothsayer and had a power of foresight that the rest of us didn't. Of course, John Kerr already had his history as a anti-union lawyer, supporter of the right-wing Catholic groupers during the split, and also, I think, a lawyer for the Vesties, if I'm not wrong. Owners of the pastoral land that Indigenous workers
the great industrial dispute up north, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. So John Kerr's reputation already preceded him.
Yes, and of course we move on. Monica talked a bit about the amalgamation. You want to go on to that issue at all?
Sure. Well, look, by the 1990s with economic rationalism in Australia from both sides of politics, but first and foremost you'd have to say the Hawke and Keating governments, and then particularly with Jeff Kennett's savage attacks on public transport and unionism in public transport in the 1990s, basically, the public transport unions had worked out that they had to come together and that it just wasn't viable for them to be separate unions standing apart from each other anymore. The main public transport unions being the Australian Railways Union, the Tramway Motive Omnibus Employees Association, the Tramways Union, the AFL-ELE, the Australian Federated Union of Locomotive Enginemen, the Train Drivers Union, and the NUR, the National Union of Railway Men. There are about four unions and then some smaller ones as well. All of them by no means had identical histories and traditions and by no means had seen eye to eye in the past, but basically they realised that at that point they either had to sink or swim. So from the early 1990s onwards, those four unions came together and formed the RTPU. Originally it was known as the Public Transport Union, but from about 3 or 4 years in, it was known as the Rail, Tram and Bus Union. So having a single amalgamated union covering most of public transport is a relatively recent thing in the history of Australian unionism. Yeah.
Have you any comment, Monica, at this stage on what Jack's been talking about?
Am I still on? Yep.
Yeah. Any comment? Yeah.
No, it's just kind of you've done that in about 10 minutes, Jack. I suppose I remember. It takes me back to remember how proud I felt. I think to be a member of the Trammies Union. And you're talking about the Clary O'Shea dispute, and it was always part of the history that people knew who worked on the unions. Who worked on the trams. It was, I guess, interesting because you've always got different political complexions. Also, even in the depots, I can remember being in a depot and there were people there who were known groupers. But it was the day when we were still all part of the union. There's no ifs and buts.
Mm.
And so we got back to what we started with, Kevin, no ticket, no start.
No ticket, no start.
There was a huge huge dispute in the tramways once where someone refused to join the union. And the whole place just stopped.
Yeah.
Mm.
So that wonderful history and the different political complexions that were sort of were part of that too, with those different traditions. And even in the life of one union, you had different shades of political colour, often in leadership, over the history of unions. So a very fascinating organism in itself as
Comment
well.
There, Jack, we've got about 2 minutes left.
Sure. I was about to say to Monica that she might like to talk to listeners about the history around the taking on of female tram drivers and Joyce Barry, but I'm not sure if there's enough time for that now.
No, another day.
It's next Mayday.
I think, that was... I do remember that you don't need balls to drive a tram, I believe.
That's right. That's right. I don't need teeth to drive a tram. Joyce Barry said that's right.
That working together thing is so important. I know when I, working as a journalist for years, whenever the printers were on strike, I always argued that journalists should go out simultaneously and vice versa. If we were taking action, the printers should support us. And I think, that having separate unions and one group working when the other isn't never works in favour of the workers, unfortunately.
No, that's right. The idea was one big industrial union. We're a long, long way from that now, probably further away than ever at the moment in the history of Australian unionism. But that's what the goal has to be. But it needs to be rank and file driven from the ground up, not a bureaucratic behemoth.
Well, sadly, of course, the Clary O'Shea story does also sadly reflect on the fact that that couldn't happen today with the current situation with unions. And we need to get back to that sort of thing.
Absolutely. We need to break out of the shackles of enterprise bargaining for starters.
Hear on that one. Yeah, I think we were going to make a comment because I'd raised the issue about the community and I'd raised
half
also
a minute
just to mention what's happening in Parliament today. I mentioned the accessible tram campaign, Karina.
Yeah, that's the rally that I met you. That's what I remember. The Sydney Road Accessible Tram Stops campaign are delivering their petition to Parliament to be debated today. So we will, as always, follow up on this issue to talk about when we have more than a few seconds.
That's right.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Jack and Monica.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Next week, energy.
Energy.